Crux wishes to thank our advertising sponsor, PushPay, for their support of Crux and this episode of Last Week in the Church. If your parish wants to increase giving, deepen engagement, and fulfill their mission, then PushPay's all-in-one digital solution, Parish Stack, is what you need. Learn more at pushpay.com.
Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, your host here on Last Week in the Church, the show where we harvest the fruits of the last week on the Vatican beat. My wife, Lisa, and I are actually not in Rome this week, but that doesn't mean that the Vatican has taken a hiatus. On the contrary, it has been another jam-packed week, so here's what we've got for you. We begin with Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. The Pope's home country elects, in effect, an anti-pope, a new president who stands four square against virtually every principle of Pope Francis's social and political agenda, and who has publicly insulted the Pope on multiple occasions. For bonus points, his running mate is a devotee of the old traditional Latin Mass, the suppression of which has been a cornerstone of the Pope's ecclesiastical agenda. So we'll try to explain what this apparent rebuff might mean, including its consequences for the much-anticipated and long-awaited papal homecoming. Second this week, we've got Doing the Dubia. So this is not a repeat, okay? Once again this week, we had another public response from the Vatican to dubia, that is, doubts, submitted to it by a bishop. In this case, it had to do with whether Catholics can still be Masons, or can be Masons. Spoiler alert, the answer is no. We'll try to unpack why that's the answer, but more deeply than that, how do we explain this recent flurry of answers to dubia when the old policy used to be to sweep them under the rug? Third up this week, we've got Balancing Act. This coming Wednesday, Pope Francis is going to meet two different groups. One, family members of Israeli hostages being held by Hamas. And secondly, Palestinians who have been driven from their homes by the ongoing war on the Gaza Strip. It is another effort by the Vatican to try to seem even-handed in a way that likely will fully please nobody. We'll explain what's going on. Fourth this week, we've got London Calling. The Vatican's slow-moving trial of the century is presently lumbering towards its conclusion. A ruling, however, this week from a different court in the UK represents a setback for the Vatican, may actually compel it to disclose confidential communications between two of its most senior officials. We'll explain what the ruling means and what its consequences might be for the Vatican's own trial. And then finally, ipse dixit, he himself said it. Only in this case, we don't actually know if he said it. A new giallo, or mystery, has emerged in Rome. But whether Pope Francis actually said something, we'll explain what's going on there. All that and more is waiting for you on this edition of Last Week in the Church, so please stay where you are. This is our official Last Week in the Church infomercial, because I come to you with a special offer for all of those would-be Catholic eggheads out there. That is, if you're the kind of person who likes sounding smart, who likes creating the impression that you know things other people don't. That certainly describes me. If that describes you, you're going to want to know about this. Now, I've already spoken about this new app, this new online resource called Magisterium AI. Basically, what it allows you to do is to type in a question like, what does it mean that the Pope is infallible? Or what does the Catholic Church teach about the environment? Or, you know, whatever. And it will give you a short, smart, easily digestible answer based on more than 5,000 official magisterial texts. But recently, these guys have created a new feature on the app. It's called the Scholarly Mode, which draws not just on official texts, but also the best and brightest of Catholic thinkers and theologians over the centuries, from Augustine and Aquinas to more contemporary figures. And we'll also give you a very quick answer about what those folks have had to say about what the Church teaches on various issues. Now, I promise you that if you try this once, you're going to wonder how in God's name you ever lived without it. It's brought to you by our friends at Longbeard. They are the digital marketing design company that provide the IT backbone for Crux. They provide the same service for a slew of other Catholic organizations and outfits. They're brilliant, and they are creative, and they are tremendous. And I'm kind of out of adjectives, at this point, which is saying something because I traffic in adjectives, but I am telling you, these people are the absolute level best. So check it out. This is Magisterium AI, their new scholarly mode. You're going to dig it. Magisterium.com, that is Magisterium.com. It comes with my personal guarantee. All right, everybody, happy Tuesday to you. Happy Tuesday, November 21st in the year of our Lord, 2023. If you're a regular watcher of Last Week in the Church, you will obviously have already discerned, to use, you know, the buzzword par excellence of the Pope Francis era, you will have discerned that we are not broadcasting this week from our normal location in our studio at St. Mary Major in Rome. Instead, Elise and I are on the road. We are coming to you from Denver, Colorado, where we are spending Thanksgiving with Elise and my, well, Elise's natural family, my adopted family. But as I said at the top of the show, the fact that we're not in Rome doesn't mean that Rome is on hiatus. In fact, lots of stuff is happening. So let's break it all down for you. We begin with Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. So Sunday night, people of the Pope's home country in Argentina went to the polls to elect a new president. Their options were a self-described anarcho-capitalist who represents a full frontal rejection, more or less, of Pope Francis's political and social agenda, or a central-left candidate who is a Peronist, who is, roughly speaking, that's the political movement that the Pope himself would identify with. So in other words, it shaped up in a way as a referendum, yes or no, to the Pope Francis agenda. And that's not just journalistic supposition. I would point out that a number of influential Catholics in Argentina, most notably these so-called slum priests, these are priests who live in what Argentines call the vicious miserias, the villas of misery, alongside the poor and who minister to the poor. These slum priests were very vocal in campaigning against the anarcho-capitalist candidate, Javier Milei. In fact, one famous slum priest said out loud that no Catholic in good faith could possibly vote for that candidate. Well, in the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, the anarcho-capitalist anti-pope won in a landslide. Milei defeated Sergio Massa by roughly 56-44%, one of the largest margins of victory in recent Argentine political history. And what the consequences of that will be for church-state relations with, you know, Francis in Rome, but very much with his hand still in Argentina, and a president in Argentina who in many ways represents a social agenda at odds with the vision of the Pope. You know, there are so many unknowns there in terms of how that's going to play out. It's going to be fascinating to watch. One immediate issue, however, is what implications this may have for Francis's long-delayed homecoming trip to Argentina. Remember, he has been talking about returning to Argentina periodically for the last 10 years. And prior to this election, it looked as if the moment might finally be at hand. He has said out loud, publicly, on a number of different occasions, that he is planning to go to Argentina next year, that is 2024. Presumably, it would be early in 2024, because, of course, in the fall of 2024, he has the second edition of his Synod of Bishops. Now, however, the great unknown is he still going to go? I mean, does he want to go to his home country and hand a massive Olympic-sized photo op to a guy who has publicly called the Pope, and I am quoting here, an imbecile, a communist, someone who stands on the side of evil, and sorry folks, I know this is a family program, but a son of a bitch, okay? Milei has said all of that at one point or another with regard to Pope Francis. And again, for bonus points, I would point out his running mate, Victoria Villarruel, is known in Argentina, among other things, as a devotee of the Lefebvreists, that is, the breakaway Catholic splinter group that is attached to celebration of the traditional Latin Mass, which, of course, is not exactly coherent either with Pope Francis's liturgical and ecclesiological outlook. So, it's going to be fascinating to watch how all of this develops. One would expect the new administration in Argentina to try to make some gestures of reconciliation with the Pope. How open the Pope is going to be to those gestures, that remains to be seen. Historically, I think there's an interesting footnote here, which is, can you name another time when a Pope's home country so clearly repudiated his outlook in a democratic election? It's a bit of a trick question because we're not talking about 2,000 years of history. I mean, the birth of modern democracy is fairly recent. And prior to John Paul II, popes were almost uniformly Italian for hundreds of years. Italy has only been a democracy since 1948, right? So there aren't that many different situations one could sift through. But the truth of it is, I think the only example I can think of would be 1870, when Italian unification was achieved down the barrel of a gun from the armies of the Savoy dynasty and the Piedmont in the north. Referenda were organized in the former papal states to see if people wanted to join the new kingdom. The vote was overwhelmingly yes, but of course, as I said, that vote was a little bit stacked in the sense that voting no would have made you an enemy of the new state. It was, well, let's just put it mildly, actively discouraged. This might be the first time in a free and fair election where residents, citizens of a pope's home country basically voted no to the agenda that he would popularly be seen as representing. Fascinating stuff. We will continue to watch how it develops. All right. Second up this week, we've got doing the dubia. So, you know, as we all know, at the beginning of Francis's papacy, in the early stages, when he called the two synods on the family and was openly flirting with the idea of a kind of cautious approval for divorced and civilly remarried Catholics to receive communion in the other sacraments of the church, a group of conservative cardinals, including American Cardinal Raymond Burke, famously submitted a set of dubia or doubts to the Pope, which for years went unanswered. That is, unanswered by the Pope himself or anybody in officialdom. Various other figures purporting to lesser and greater degrees to speak in the name of the Pope gave replies, but officially what we got from the Vatican was the sound of silence. And the conclusion that was drawn really was, don't bother submitting dubia because you're not going to get an answer. Well, of late, that policy has been thrown out the window, and in fact what we now have is a kind of dubia of the week club. Over the course of the last month and a half, we have seen public responses from either the Pope personally or the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith to four different sets of dubia. One submitted by another group of conservative cardinals, again, including Cardinal Burke, on the issues of the blessing of same-sex unions and also women clergy. Another by a cardinal out of the Czech Republic on the issue of communion for divorced and remarried Catholics. Third from a bishop in Brazil about transsexuals and whether they could serve as godparents or be baptized, have their own children baptized, be witnesses at church weddings. Now, this past week, we got the latest, which was a dubia from a bishop in the Philippines as to whether the Vatican's traditional position that Catholics should not be Freemasons, whether that position still stands. The answer given was, yes, it does, or to put it differently, the answer is a big fat no, as to whether Catholics can also be Masons. Now, this is one of those cases in which being an American puts us at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of making sense of this, because I know in the United States, we often think of the Masons as basically a kind of social club, and it's hard for us to understand why the Vatican would get worked up over it. However, a little bit of history and a little bit of theology is in order here. There are a set of doctrines that are connected to Masonry. And if you tease out the implications of those doctrines, they can lead to things like pantheism, rationalism, naturalism, all of them obviously at odds with Orthodox Catholic teaching. So that is one reason why the Vatican historically has been, well, excuse the phrase, but dubious about Masons. The other part of it is historical. In Italy in particular, during that press for Italian unification that we talked about a moment ago, Masons were actively involved in trying to bring down the papal states to end the Pope's temporal authority. The Vatican has long memories. More recently, in the 1970s and 80s, an influential Masonic lodge in Italy known as P2, Propaganda 2, played a key and not particularly healthy role in the Vatican bank scandals that took a real toll, not only on the Vatican's finances, but also its moral standing and credibility. All of that is in the mix. In any event, bottom line it for you, no. Officially speaking, if you're a Catholic, you're not supposed to be a Mason. Now, I think the more interesting question here probably is, why all of a sudden is it the case that the Dicastery for the Faith apparently has never seen a dubia it doesn't want to answer? Like when the old policy used to be just benign neglect. And I think there are probably a couple of factors at work here. One is that the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith is now led by someone who was unquestionably the Pope's guy, Argentine Cardinal Victor Fernandez, who has been the eminence grise, the theological major domo, the right hand of Pope Francis informally from the very beginning, but now is formally in charge. He's the Vatican's doctrinal czar. Presumably, Francis simply has greater confidence in letting him answer these questions as they come along. But secondly, there's probably also a question of the phase of the papacy that we're in. To put it differently, one suspects that Pope Francis is hearing time's winged chariot hurrying near. That is, at the beginning of his papacy, he might have been comfortable with saying, let's just see how this play out. I don't necessarily need to wade into this right now. But at this phase, when he undoubtedly senses that he is nearer the end than the beginning, he probably is anxious to nail down his legacy and less inclined, therefore, to tolerate unfinished business. However one explains it, ladies and gentlemen, there is a new rule in Catholic life, and that rule is as follows. If you don't want the answer, don't ask the question. Because the bottom line is, if you ask the Vatican a question today, bishops of the world take note, you're going to get an answer. Whether you like it or not is a different question. All right, third up this week, we've got balancing act. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, the Vatican has confirmed that this coming Wednesday, so tomorrow, the Pope is going to be receiving two different groups in brief encounters around the edges of his regular weekly general audience. One will be a group of family members of those Israeli hostages who have been taken by Hamas. The other will be a group of Gazans who have been forced from their homes because of the shelling and the combat that is taking place on the Gaza Strip. Obviously, this is an effort on the part of the Vatican to make clear that it is not taking sides, that it's not trying to endorse either party to this conflict. Now, doing so is certainly consistent with the Vatican's historical, traditional effort to remain super partes, right? Above the parties, above the fray. And the idea being that by not taking sides, the Vatican therefore can position itself to potentially be a mediator, to broker peace talks, and so on, and also to encourage humanitarian gestures along the way. However, it probably should be said that Israelis, and many Jews in particular, are likely to be somewhat frustrated by this because in their eyes, this is likely to be seen as another failure on the part of Pope Francis and the Vatican to issue a clear and unequivocal moral condemnation of terrorism generally and Hamas in particular. Since the Hamas sneak attacks on October 7th, that really is what Israelis and many Jews and others have been looking for from the Vatican. And of course, this balancing act this week comes on the heels of a number of episodes that have sort of left a bitter aftertaste in the mouths of many Israelis and many Jews. That includes the fact that this is not the first time this group of family members of hostages requested a meeting with the Pope. They first asked for it in October when they came to Rome. They were received by the Italian Prime Minister, but they were informed by the Vatican that the Pope was too busy with the Synod of Bishops to meet them then. This despite the fact that he kept up a regular schedule of other audiences while the Synod was underway. And also, recently, the Pope skipped reading a speech to a group of European rabbis on a day when he had four other audiences and delivered every single speech in every one of them. All of this has created some frustration among Israelis, including Israeli diplomats, and also Jewish sympathizers and supporters of Israel, and others, of course, who would be supportive of Israel. The drumbeat of criticism basically boils down to, there are times when being even-handed doesn't cut it. There are times when there is clearly an injured party and an aggressor. That is, there is a victim and a victimizer. And these critics would say that the Hamas terrorist attacks on Israel, including the taking of these hostages, is a clear cut-and-dried instance of that difference, and they would like the Pope to be more forthright and outspoken. The plain reality, however, is that what Wednesday confirms is the Vatican is likely to maintain its traditional stance of neutrality, again, in the hopes that, number one, that will position them behind the scenes to make a diplomatic difference. Number two, of course, because their people on the ground are Palestinians. The overwhelming majority of the Christian population in the Holy Land are Arab Palestinian Christians. The Vatican feels a natural sympathy for them. All right, fourth up this week, London Calling. So, the Vatican's trial of the century, involving charges of financial crime against 10 defendants, including Italian Cardinal Angelo Becciu, Pope's former chief of staff, is currently lurching towards its conclusion after 3 years. The presiding judge has said that we're supposed to get a verdict in the middle of next month. December 16th, tentatively, has been set as the target date. However, the disputed real estate deal in London that is at the heart of this transaction, remember the Vatican poured about $400 million down a black hole trying to purchase a former Harrods warehouse in the Chelsea neighborhood of London, and that's what started this whole mess. That's an object of litigation, not just in the Vatican, but also in other parts of the world. In 2020, a guy by the name of Raffaele Mincioni, one of the defendants in the Vatican case, filed what amounts to a countersuit against the Vatican in the UK for damage to his reputation. Now, at the time, in 2020, the judges in the UK ruled that case had to wait until the Vatican prosecution was over. But last August, they reversed that decision. They let the case go forward. So it is currently being adjudicated in a commercial court in the UK. And this week, it was revealed that that court has ordered the Vatican to turn over scores of confidential communications through email and WhatsApp and Telegram and other social media platforms between Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, the number two official in the system after the Pope, and Parolin's top deputy, Venezuelan Archbishop Edgar Peña Parra, regarding this London real estate deal. Mincioni's lawyers had asked for these documents. The Vatican submitted a piece of witness testimony, arguing that these documents were covered by pontifical secrecy, that revealing them would be a grave sin. Further, argued that there was no compelling motive to turn them over because, they claimed, Parolin had only a peripheral role in the London transaction. Now, that's something that Mincioni's lawyers obviously pushed back against, because the truth of it is, every document that authorized this transaction at all of its different stages was signed by Parolin. There is a paper trail a mile long. And they also argued that pontifical secrecy in this case doesn't apply because we're not talking about matters of the faith, we're talking about a commercial transaction, which in most nations' laws has always been regarded as an exception to sovereign immunity. So the court has ordered the Vatican to produce these communications and to enter them into evidence in the trial, therefore to make them public. Now, presumably, the Vatican is going to appeal, and, you know, it may be some time, if ever, before these communications see the light of day. But certainly what we can say for now, it is another instance in which an independent secular court has taken a look at the same charges that are at issue in the Vatican trial and basically said, we're not buying it. That is, the arguments that have been made by Vatican prosecutors in its own trial are being rejected by courts and judges in other settings. That may not affect the verdict in the Vatican case, but it certainly might affect the perception of the legitimacy of that verdict once it's finally delivered. As ever, we will have our eyes on the prize. Finally, this week, we've got ipse dixit. So, you know, the Pope is one of the highest profile figures in the world. You would think, therefore, that there would never be any confusion as to whether a Pope actually said something, A, because somebody is always listening when the Pope speaks, and B, if there is confusion about what a Pope said, he's got an entire army of spokespersons and spin doctors and apologists and commentators and pundits who can set the record straight. And yet, a persistent feature of the Pope story in recent times has been these occasional, what the Italians would call a giallo, that is a mystery about whether the Pope actually said something. I mean, I don't know if you remember the famous It Is As It Was episode in the John Paul papacy with regard to the Mel Gibson movie The Passion of the Christ, where it was reported, then denied, then semi-confirmed, then semi-denied, that John Paul had said It Is As It Was, meaning that the film was a faithful presentation of the Gospels. I mean, you know, that happened, what, a decade, more than a decade ago? And to be honest with you, almost 2 decades ago now, and to be honest with you, we still have no idea what the Pope actually said. And that has happened under Francis as well. Early on, you will remember, he gave a series of interviews to a secular, non-believing journalist in Italy by the name of Eugenio Scalfari. Scalfari quoted Francis as saying all kinds of things, including that hell doesn't exist, that there is no such thing as absolute truth, and on and on. The Vatican, in every case, said, well, you know, these are not necessarily direct quotes, but they didn't exactly disavow them either. And to this day, again, it's not entirely clear what the Pope actually said. We have another such situation this week. The Pope went to the eastern outskirts of Rome to meet with about 40 Roman priests who serve in that area, had a private meeting with them. Now, there was no official recording, no official transcript. The Vatican has refused to comment about the content of this thing. But the next day, an influential Italian blog titled Silere Non Possum, which is Latin for I Cannot Keep Silent, published a lengthy transcript with all kinds of things, including the Pope saying, you're going to say I'm a Lutheran because of my position on the divorced and remarried, saying you're going to call me a relativist, well, let's hope it's a fruitful relativism, and taking a shot at Anglo-Saxons, saying we Latins are close to the people, but in Anglo-Saxon culture, you've got clericalism, which is bad, as if the only clericalists out there are Anglo-Saxons. Now, the thing of it is, those are all juicy quotes. We have no idea whether the Pope actually said them, because this blog didn't tell us where it got its information. Officially, the Vatican is taking the old, tried and true, no comment line. Everybody seems comfortable with just leaving this hanging, so that if you want to believe the Pope said it, you can. If you don't want to, that's an equally valid option. It is an option for confusion. Ladies and gentlemen, wish I could tell you that I have the inside scoop. I don't. All I can tell you is it is another fascinating footnote to the drama of the Francis papacy. All right, that is our show for this week. You'll find full coverage of all of these stories on the Crux site. That is cruxnow.com. cruxnow.com. For those of you who are watching in the United States, have a beautiful Thanksgiving this week. And for those of you who are watching from elsewhere, well, be thankful anyway, because if you think about it, there's always something to be grateful for. Have a fantastic and blessed week. Stay safe, stay healthy. We will talk to you again very soon.